Chapter 2. Bell, which still sounds in my ears unlike all other bells and music plays, amidst a buzz of voices, and a fragrant smell of orange peel and oil. Anon, the magic bell commands the music to cease, and the great green curtain rolls itself up majestically, and the play begins. The devoted dog of Montargis avenges the death of his master, foully murdered in the forest of Pondy, and a humorous peasant with a red nose and a very little hat, whom I take from this hour forth to my bosom as a friend. I think he was a waiter, or an hostler at a village inn, but many years have passed since he and I have met, remarks that the sagacity of that dog is indeed surprising, and evermore this jocular conceit will live in my remembrance fresh and unfading, overtopping all possible jokes, unto the end of time. Or now, I learn with bitter tears how poor Jane Shore, dressed all in white, and with her brown hair hanging down, went starving through the streets, or how George Barnwell killed the worthiest uncle that ever man had, and was afterwards so sorry for it that he ought to have been let off. Come swift to comfort me, the pantomime's stupendous phenomenon. When clowns are shot from loaded mortars into the great chandelier, bright constellation that it is, when harlequins, covered all over with scales of pure gold, twist and sparkle like amazing fish, when Pantaloon, whom I deem it no your reverence to compare in my own mind to my grandfather, puts red-hot pokers in his pocket, and cries, "Here's somebody coming," or taxes the clown with petty larceny, by saying, "Now, I saw you do it," when everything is capable, with the greatest ease, of being changed into anything, and nothing is, but thinking makes it so. Now too, I perceive my first experience of the dreary sensation often, to return in after life of being unable next day, to get back to the dull, settled world, of wanting to live forever in the bright atmosphere I have quitted, of doting on the little fairy, with the wand like a celestial barber's pole, and pining for a fairy immortality along with her. Ah, she comes back, in many shapes, as my eye wanders down the branches of my Christmas tree, and goes as often, and has never yet stayed by me. Out of this delight springs the toy theater, there it is, with its familiar proscenium, and ladies in feathers, in the boxes, and all its attendant occupation with paste and glue, and gum, and watercolors, in the getting up of the miller and his men, and Elizabeth, or the exile of Siberia. In spite of a few besetting accidents, and failures, particularly an unreasonable disposition in the respectable Kelmer, and some others, to become faint in the legs, and double up, at exciting points of the drama, a teeming world of fancy so suggestive and all-embracing, that, far below it on my Christmas tree, I see dark, dirty, real theaters in the daytime, adorned with these associations, as with the freshest garlands of the rarest flowers, and charming me yet. But hark! The waits are playing, and they break my childish sleep. What images do I associate with the Christmas music as I see them set forth on the Christmas tree? Known before all the others, keeping far apart from all the others, they gather round my little bed. An angel, speaking to a group of shepherds in a field, some travelers, with eyes uplifted, following a star, a baby in a manger, a child in a spacious temple, talking with grave men, a solemn figure, with a mild and beautiful face, raising a dead girl by the hand, again, near a city gate, calling back the son of a widow, on his bier, to life, a crowd of people looking through the opened roof of a chamber where he sits, and letting down a sick person on a bed, with ropes, the same, in a tempest, walking on the water to a ship, again, on a seashore, teaching a great multitude, again, with a child upon his knee, and other children round, again, restoring sight to the blind, speech to the dumb, hearing to the deaf, health to the sick, strength to the lame, knowledge to the ignorant, again, dying upon a cross, watched by armed soldiers, a thick darkness coming on, the earth beginning to shake, and only one voice heard, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." Still, on the lower and mature branches of the tree, Christmas associations cluster thick. School books shut up, Ovid and Virgil silenced. The rule of three, with its cool impertinent inquiries, long disposed of. Tyrants and Plautus acted no more, in an arena of huddled desks and forms, all chipped, and notched, and inked. Cricket bats, stumps, and balls, left higher up, with the smell of trodden grass, and the softened noise of shouts in the evening air. The tree is still fresh, still gay. If I no more come home at Christmas time, there will be boys and girls, thank heaven. While the world lasts, and they do. Yonder they dance, and play upon the branches of my tree, God bless them, merrily, and my heart dances and plays too. And I do come home at Christmas. We all do, or we all should. We all come home, or ought to come home, for a short holiday the longer, the better from the great boarding school, where we are forever working at our arithmetical slates, to take, and give a rest. As to going a visiting, where can we not go, if we will? Where have we not been, when we would? Starting our fancy from our Christmas tree. Away into the winter prospect. There are many such upon the tree. On, by low-lying, misty grounds, through fens and fogs, up long hills, winding dark as caverns between thick plantations, almost shutting out the sparkling stars. So, out on broad heights, until we stop at last, with sudden silence, at an avenue. The gate bell has a deep, half-awful sound in the frosty air. The gate swings open on its hinges, and, as we drive up to a great house, the glancing lights grow larger in the windows, and the opposing rows of trees seem to fall solemnly back on either side, to give us place. At intervals, all day, a frightened hare has shot across this whitened turf, or the distant clatter of a herd of deer trampling the hard frost, has, for the minute, crushed the silence too. Their watchful eyes beneath the fern may be shining now, if we could see them, like the icy dewdrops on the leaves, but they are still, and all is still. And so, the lights growing larger, and the trees falling back before us, and closing up again behind us, as if to forbid retreat, we come to the house. There is probably a smell of roasted chestnuts, and other good comfortable things all the time, for we are telling winter stories, ghost stories, or more shame for us round the Christmas fire, and we have never stirred, except to draw a little nearer to it. But, no matter for that. We came to the house, and it is an old house, full of great chimneys, where wood is burnt on ancient dogs upon the hearth, and grim portraits, some of them with grim legends, to lower distrustfully from the oaken panels of the walls. We are a middle-aged nobleman, and we make a generous supper with our host, and hostess and their guests at being Christmas time, and the old house full of company, and then we go to bed. Our room is a very old room. It is hung with tapestry. We don't like the portrait of a cavalier in green, over the fireplace. There are great black beams in the ceiling, and there is a great black bedstead, supported at the foot by two great black figures, who seem to have come off a couple of tombs in the old baronial church in the park, for our particular accommodation. But, we are not a superstitious nobleman, and we don't mind. Well, we dismiss our servant, lock the door, and sit before the fire in our dressing gown, musing about a great many things. At length we go to bed. Well, we can't sleep. We toss and tumble, and can't sleep. The embers on the hearth burn fitfully, and make the room look ghostly. We can't help peeping out over the counterpane, at the two black figures and the cavalier, that wicked-looking cavalier in green. In the flickering light they seem to advance and retire, which, though we are not by any means a superstitious nobleman, is not agreeable. Well, we get nervous more and more nervous. We say this is very foolish, but we can't stand this. We'll pretend to be ill, and knock up somebody. Well, we are just going to do it, when the locked door opens, and there comes in a young woman, deadly pale, and with long fair hair, who glides to the fire, and sits down in the chair we have left there, wringing her hands. Then, we notice that our clothes are wet. Our tongue cleaves to the roof of our mouth, and we can't speak, but we observe her accurately. Her clothes are wet, her long hair is dabbled with moist mud, she is dressed in the fashion of 200 years ago, and she has at her girdle a bunch of rusty keys. Well, there she sits, and we can't even faint, we are in such a state about it. Presently she gets up, and tries all the locks in the room with the rusty keys, which won't fit one of them. Then, she fixes her eyes on the portrait of the Cavalier in green, and says, in a low, terrible voice, "The stacks know it." After that, she wrings her hands again, passes the bedside, and goes out at the door. We hurry on our dressing gown, seize our pistols, we always travel with pistols, and are following, when we find the door locked. We turn the key, look out into the dark gallery, no one there. We wander away, and try to find our servant. Can't be done. We pace the gallery till daybreak, then return to our deserted room, fall asleep, and are awakened by our servant. Nothing ever haunts him, and the shining sun. Well, we make a wretched breakfast, and all the company say we look queer. After breakfast, we go over the house with our host, and then we take him to the portrait of the Cavalier in green, and then it all comes out. He was false to a young housekeeper once attached to that family, and famous for her beauty, who drowned herself in a pond, and whose body was discovered, after a long time, because the stags refused to drink of the water. Since which, it has been whispered, that she traverses the house at midnight but goes especially to that room, where the Cavalier in green was wont to sleep, trying the old locks with the rusty keys. Well, we tell our host of what we have seen, and a shade comes over his features, and he begs it may be hushed up, and so it is. But, it's all true, and we said so, before we died, we are dead now, too many responsible people. There is no end to the old houses, with resounding galleries, and dismal state bedchambers, and haunted wings shut up for many years, through which we may ramble, with an agreeable creeping up our back, and encounter any number of ghosts, but it is worthy of remark perhaps, reducible to a very few general types and classes. For, ghosts have little originality, and walk in a beaten track. Thus, it comes to pass, that a certain room in a certain old hall, where a certain bad lord, baronet, knight, or gentleman, shot himself, has certain planks in the floor from which the blood will not be taken out. You may scrape and scrape, as the present owner has done, or plane and plane, as his father did, or scrub and scrub, as his grandfather did, or burn and burn with strong acids, as his great-grandfather did. But, there the blood will still be no redder, and no paler no more, and no less always just the same. Thus, in such another house there is a haunted door, that never will keep open, or another door, that never will keep shut, or a haunted sound of a spinning wheel, or a hammer, or a footstep, or a cry, or a sigh, or a horse's tramp, or the rattling of a chain. Or else, there is a turret clock, which, at the midnight hour, strikes 13 when the head of the family is going to die, or a shadowy, immovable black carriage which at such a time is always seen by somebody, waiting near the great gates, in the stable yard. Or thus, it came to pass how Lady Mary went to pay a visit at a large wild house in the Scottish Highlands, and, being fatigued with her long journey, retired to bed early, and innocently said, next morning, at the breakfast table, how odd, to have so late a party last night, in this remote place, and not to tell me of it, before I went to bed. Then, everyone asked Lady Mary what she meant. Then, Lady Mary replied, why, all night long, the carriages were driving round and round the terrace, underneath my window. Then, the owner of the house turned pale, and so did his lady, and Charles MacDoodle of MacDoodle signed to Lady Mary to say no more, and everyone was silent. After breakfast, Charles MacDoodle told Lady Mary that it was a tradition in the family that those rumbling carriages on the terrace betokened death. And so it proved, for, 2 months afterwards, The lady of the mansion died. And Lady Mary, who was a maid of honor at court, often told this story to the old Queen Charlotte. By this token, that the old king always said, "Eh, eh? What, what? Ghosts, ghosts? No such thing, no such thing." And never left off saying so, until he went to bed. Or, a friend of somebody's whom most of us know, when he was a young man at college, had a particular friend, with whom he made the compact that, if it were possible for the spirit, to return to this earth after its separation from the body, he of the twain who first died, should reappear to the other. In course of time, this compact was forgotten by our friend. The two young men having progressed in life, and taken diverging paths, that were wide asunder. But, one night, many years afterwards, our friend being in the north of England, and staying for the night in an inn, on the Yorkshire moors, happened to look out of bed. And there, in the moonlight, leaning on a bureau near the window, steadfastly regarding him, saw his old college friend. The appearance being solemnly addressed, replied, in a kind of whisper, but very audibly, "Do not come near me. I am dead. I am here to redeem my promise. I come from another world, but may not disclose its secrets." Then, the whole form becoming paler, melted, as it were, into the moonlight, and faded away. Or, there was the daughter of the first occupier of the picturesque Elizabethan house, so famous in our neighborhood. You have heard about her? No. Why, she went out one summer evening at twilight, when she was a beautiful girl, just 17 years of age, to gather flowers in the garden, and presently came running, terrified, into the hall to her father, saying, "Oh, dear father, I have met myself." He took her in his arms, and told her it was fancy, but she said, "Oh no! I met myself in the broad walk, and I was pale and gathering withered flowers, and I turned my head, and held them up. And, that night, she died, and a picture of her story was begun, though never finished, and they say it is somewhere in the house to this day, with its face to the wall." Or, the uncle of my brother's wife was riding home on horseback, one mellow evening at sunset, when, in a green lane close to his own house, he saw a man standing before him, in the very center of a narrow way. "Why does that man in the cloak stand there?" he thought. "Does he want me to ride over him?" But the figure never moved. He felt a strange sensation at seeing it so still, but slackened his trot and rode forward. When he was so close to it, as almost to touch it with his stirrup, his horse shied, and the figure glided up the bank, in a curious, unearthly manner backward, and without seeming to use its feet, and was gone. The uncle of my brother's wife, exclaiming, "Good heaven! It's my cousin Harry, from Bombay," put spurs to his horse, which was suddenly in a profuse sweat, and, wondering at such strange behavior, dashed round to the front of his house. There, he saw the same figure, just passing in at the long French window of the drawing room, opening on the ground. He threw his bridle to a servant, and hastened in after it. His sister was sitting there, alone. "Alice, where's my cousin Harry?" "Your cousin Harry, John?" "Yes. From Bombay. I met him in the lane just now, and saw him enter here, this instant." Not a creature had been seen by anyone, and in that hour and minute, as it afterwards appeared, this cousin died in India. Or, it was a certain sensible old maiden lady, who died at 99, and retained her faculties to the last, who really did see the orphan boy, a story which has often been incorrectly told, but, of which the real truth is this, because it is, in fact, a story belonging to our family, and she was a connection of our family. When she was about 40 years of age, and still an uncommonly fine woman, her lover died young, which was the reason why she never married, though she had many offers. She went to stay at a place in Kent, which her brother, an Indian merchant, had newly bought. There was a story that this place had once been held in trust by the guardian of a young boy, who was himself the next heir, and who killed the young boy by harsh and cruel treatment. She knew nothing of that. It has been said that there was a cage in her bedroom in which the guardian used to put the boy. There was no such thing. There was only a closet. She went to bed, made no alarm whatever in the night, and in the morning said composedly to her maid when she came in, "Who is the pretty forlorn-looking child who has been peeping out of that closet all night?" The maid replied by giving a loud scream, and instantly decamping. She was surprised. But she was a woman of remarkable strength of mind, and she dressed herself and went downstairs, and closeted herself with her brother. "Now, Walter," she said, "I have been disturbed all night by a pretty, forlorn-looking boy, who has been constantly peeping out of that closet in my room, which I can't open. This is some trick." "I am afraid not, Charlotte," said he, "for it is the legend of the house. It is the orphan boy." "What did he do?" "He opened the door softly," said she, "and peeped out. Sometimes, he came a step or two into the room. Then, I called to him, to encourage him, and he shrunk, and shuddered, and crept in again, and shut the door." "The closet has no communication, Charlotte," said her brother, "with any other part of the house, and it's nailed up." This was undeniably true, and it took two carpenters a whole forenoon to get it open, for examination. Then, she was satisfied that she had seen the orphan boy. But, the wild and terrible part of the story is, that he was also seen by three of her brother's sons, in succession, who all died young. On the occasion of each child being taken ill, he... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.